Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College, all things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there, and of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. Morning, Glory America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt on this Wednesday morning from inside the Beltway. Good morning to you. Israel has not responded yet. They are planning to. That's according to the United Kingdom's Foreign Minister, David Cameron, who is the reincarnated soul of Lord Halifax, who is Neville Chamberlain's foreign minister. But Cameron talked to enough Israelis that he came away and say it's clear that Israel has decided to respond, and he urged de-escalation. But these people, de-escalation. 330 missiles, cruise missiles, ballistic missiles and drones launched at Israel to de-escalate? I don't think so. Meanwhile, Iran's not doing anything to encourage de-escalation. In fact, they had a military parade yesterday, slamming the countries that normalized relations with Israel, hailing the success of its attack. You see, it's necessary to put Iran back in its box, hopefully a casket, the Iranian regime, in order to keep the Abraham Accords going and peace in the Middle East progressing. The president, remember, the supreme leader of Iran is Khamenei. The president of Iran comes and goes, and it doesn't really matter. They're all subject to Khamenei, and Khamenei is a fundamentalist theocrat who believes Israel needs to be destroyed. And if people in the West would understand, they don't want anything except Israel to be destroyed. That's all they want. Then they want the United States to be crippled and, if possible, destroyed. Then they'll get about their project of destroying Sunni Islam as opposed to Shia Islam. But their first step is destroy Israel. And Raisi is the current president of Iran, ceremonial post in large respect, warned Israel against the slightest response to the weekend attack. And you know what? Good. Warn all you want. When Israel hits you, then we'll know what's going on. Embolden Iran makes dangerous gamble on confrontation. Long analysis in the Wall Street Journal. Doesn't much matter. Nobody knows what's going on. Nobody understands what the option table is. There are 100 options. Israel can do 100 things. They can destroy the oil industry of Iran. They can destroy every power-generating facility in Iran. They can plunge the state into darkness and into economic woe and despair and hope that an uprising follows. They can try and hit the nuclear sites, though they're very deeply, heavily, heavily covered from the top. But I still think they could shake the centrifuges a bit. They could destroy the IRGC headquarters. They can do any number of things. Right now they're keeping Iran tensed. How weak is Iran? They used footage of a hysterical Lewis Tomlinson fan running at a concert to show that Israelis were panicking. They're not. Israel weighs a response to Iran attack, with each choice a risk. This is the long New York Times hand-wringing about the fact that Israel's going to crush a bunch of Iranians and hopefully do so directly. Not Hezbollah, not the IRGC deployed in Syria and Lebanon, but right at Iran. Then we're going to talk later in the program with Mark Montgomery. Admiral Montgomery is retired. But it's clear, according to the Wall Street Journal, that our drone and missile warfare supply system is stressed. And of course it is. We've provided Ukraine, and we have to provide Ukraine attackums and various aeromissile systems to protect Ukraine's critical infrastructure. We're doing the same with Israel, and we're doing the same for ourselves in Taiwan. The answer is expand the defense industrial base, stat. We'll come back to that, this subject, because Israel's got a lot of options, and I have no idea what they're going to do, and I don't believe any leaks. I think five people know in the Israeli government, the three members of the war cabinet, well, six people. Derry is also an observer in there, along with Dermer and Gantz's deputy. So there are six observers, but three votes. Gantz, Israeli Defense Minister, Gallant, and, of course, Netanyahu. They'll make the decision, but the IDF is in there as well, as is Mossad and Shin Bet. So I would guess you really have 10 to 12 people when the war cabinet gathers. They're the only ones that know what Israel's going to do. Nobody else knows. No one in America knows. They're not going to tell America. It will leak. Up in New York, the jury selection continues. Again, I'm not going to spend much time on this because there's nothing until the end. He's going to get convicted. He's going to get convicted by a New York Democratic jury. And it's not going to mean anything because it'll be thrown out on appeal. But they've got a charter school teacher, a software engineer, a salesman, two lawyers, and an oncology nurse. 7 out of the 18 jurors that they need have been selected. Michael Johnson's plan for Ukraine aid drew a second critic yesterday, Thomas Massie, who is also, you know, just out there on the fringe. And he said he's going to try and bring down the Speaker Mike Johnson. And it's narrow enough. He finds a third vote. Maybe they can get it. But I expect some Democrats actually say this is nonsense because we'll never have a speaker for the rest of the year and we've got to get this aid passed. Jay Powell, the head of the Federal Reserve, cut expectations on rate cuts. And he's saying inflation's taking longer than expected. Who knew? Who knew? Who knew that Joe Biden spending trillions of dollars we didn't need to spend and we didn't have would cause inflation? Who knew? Really? Jay Powell, sorry. Supreme Court heard arguments yesterday on the J6 rioters and one of the charges that many of them faced. And a number of judges said, this seems to me like it's void for vagueness. All right. Neil Gorsuch especially was up there saying, yeah, I'm not really sure about this. And only two judges, Elena Kagan and Sotomayor, according to the Wall Street Journal, embraced the overwhelming case that they abused a statute that's void for vagueness. President Biden spending 3 days in Pennsylvania. I feel bad for Pennsylvania. Obviously, the polling for Pennsylvania is going to go for Trump right now if the election were held today. Here's Joe Biden in Scranton, cut number two.
My grandfather would tell me when I walked out the door in North Washington Avenue in Scranton.
Oh, sure. That teleprompter is top. Keep going on, cut number three.
Because he failed to care. Not only did people die, but millions of Americans lost their jobs, their homes, their livelihoods. On Trump's watch in the 4 years he was president, we lost nearly 3 million jobs were lost.
All right. Now, I don't think any of you are stupid. You realize, of course, that's because Tony Fauci said we had to close everything down and Donald Trump listened to him. And as you should listen to your advisor, but get better advisors. Tony Fauci was wrong about everything, lied about a lot, covered up some. And we'll get to the bottom of it eventually. Then we get to the mayor of Scranton. The name is going to be tough here. Cut number four.
You know, thanks to the mayor, I was going to talk about the old mayor.
Right, you are. Cut number five.
The one that offends me the most is when he refused his president to visit an American cemetery outside of Paris. When he was president. Why? He said that those soldiers who gave their lives were, quote, was his quote, suckers and losers.
Yeah, that is kind of a lie, but the media doesn't track him down. And cut number six.
It's amazing how we had passed legislation increasing the number of auditors. Guess who wanted them all cut? No, I'm not joking.
Not joking, that means he's lying. One more cut. I want to go to cut number eight, Harley, not seven. Cut number eight, because this is just Joe Biden. Now, start over, Harley. I don't want to step on it. Go ahead, cut eight.
On a kitchen table with a guy who was sort of the David Broder of the Pennsylvania Press, the Scranton Press. You think I'm kidding, it wasn't, but anyway. And he would, they'd come and have breakfast at the table, and a kid could wander around the table where the adults were sitting, but you could never sit at the table.
There's a political reporter somewhere back 70 years ago, 80 years ago, who is the David Broder of Scranton. I guarantee you that nobody knows who David Broder is, who I'm talking to right now, unless you're over the age of 60, because David Broder hasn't been writing. Dan Balls is there. Bigfoot political reporter at the Washington Post now. So Broder's been gone a long time. So Joe Biden's 8-track tape has hit the blank spot. And if you ever come back with Amy from Pure Perry League, actually not. We're going to introduce Cliff May. But put that on your list, Adam, because that was my favorite 8-track tape until it started to skip back in the mid-70s. 8-track tape. Joe's 8-track tape skipped there. And he's trying to tell a story, and he's mixing up old reporters that he knew. And he's 81 years old. He's 81 years old. He should not be president. Pretty doggone obvious. Okay, what I'm going to do is play for you the rest of the interview I conducted with Cliff May yesterday. It's going to take the next couple of segments, but it's important. He's the president of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. I'm going to play that for you, and I'm going to be back with lots more. Don't go anywhere. I'll be right back after the break. And RIP Bob Graham. He's a Democrat, but he was a good old-fashioned Democrat from Florida. And he died at the age of 87. Another profile of Hillsdale College in the Financial Times. This one is a good one because they told the truth. Hillsdale.edu. All things Hillsdale at Hillsdale.edu. Stay tuned. Morning, Glory America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway, joined by Rear Admiral retired Mark Montgomery, 32 years in the United States Navy, now at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. Good morning, Admiral. Welcome back. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. Excellent. Thank you for having me.
I want to cut right to the chase. Israel is considering its options right now, its menus of direct retaliation against Iran. What capabilities do they have, and can any of them destroy the nuclear program?
Well, that's a really good question. So first of all, what they have is several squadrons of F-35s, several squadrons of F-15s. Those F-35s were purchased exactly for a mission against Iran. In other words, a mission to go over the very, you know, the highly defended airspace of Iran and strike targets. I think they could very realistically strike targets of, like, say, the IRGC, headquarters and things. In other words, hold the people accountable who have been working against them for the last two decades with proxies and Hezbollah and Hamas and who ordered the attack, the large-scale cruise missile attack. Or, as you implied there, they could go, and try to take out the nuclear processing facilities. That's a much harder strike. And there's some questions about whether they had the right weapons. We know the U.S. has the right weapons, but I'm not sure Israel has the weapons that can be paired with a delivery system, an aircraft, to do that kind of strike.
What are the right weapons, Admiral?
Well, for us, we use a weapon called a massive ordnance penetrator is what I would try to use, something that's delivered usually from one of our, from a stealth bomber, that could, that can deeply penetrate heavily concreted and dug in and cave-like facilities. Israel's always gone with fighters. They've eschewed, having a bomber force, for the length of their the Israeli Air Force. So there's a question about that. We have been working that issue with them because we could use a smaller version, able to be carried by an F-35 or an F-15. So, it's yet to be told. But I tell you, they could definitely take out an IRGC headquarters.
Could they also, do they have cruise missiles? And what about their ballistic missiles? Do the ballistic missiles carry a payload that could take out the nuclear sites?
I think their Jericho 2, which is their kind of IRB, intermediate range ballistic missile that could hit, that kind of range in Iran. It's accurate, but I don't know that it it has the kind of accuracy to penetrate, do the kind of strike you saw at the end of Top Gun Maverick, right? At some point, sometimes you need an aircraft to do that.
Do they have submarine launched ballistic missiles, Admiral?
It is rumored that they have a capability of striking targets with submarines, with different types of warheads.
All right. So Admiral Hugh Hewitt's view of the world is the Israelis struck the IRGC with one missile and killed seven Iranian generals. Iran struck Israel directly. And that facility was in Syria. And I don't know if it had diplomatic status or not. Some people say yes. They fired 330. I would send back 659, which is twice as many missiles, drones, and cruise missiles as were sent, minus one for the Syria one. I would do that, and I would hit everything, including their 10 refineries, and put the nation into darkness and see if chaos doesn't respond. Admiral, you're actually the strategist. I'm a talking head on radio and television. What do you think of that plan?
So what you're talking about there is deterrence by cost imposition. And there's absolutely a fair argument for that. What we saw a few nights ago is deterrence by denial, where they had such good missile defense systems, they were able to hold, to to they and the United States were able to mitigate that the attack. If they were to strike like this, it would be deterrence by cost imposition. And there's certainly an argument for that. And of all the countries that, that adhere to their own red lines and have a, don't have a say-do mismatch, I'd put Israel at the very top of that list. And so it's, you know, it's not unlikely that they'll do something. And you're right, you know, taking an economic tack to it, destroying the refineries, you know, hitting critical infrastructure, you could see that. I'd probably stick to the refineries because that affects the state. You know, when I hit the critical infrastructure, it tends to affect the people. I think there's a large percentage of the Iranian people that are tired of the Iranian government. I'd probably hit the state and really take down their ability to generate, you know, cash, especially dollars through oil exports.
Now, Admiral, in terms of the menu of options, which ones have I not talked about? Because I'm sure you know the Israelis must have an option menu of 100 different things they can do on it. Which ones haven't I talked about on the ladder? And I don't believe in the ladder because Iran jumped off the ladder, right? They didn't send in two missiles. They sent in 330 missiles.
You know, that was, you're right. First of all, I'd say that it was an escalatory strike that did not have disproportionate results, but only because the defense was so good, right? Their goal was to have an escalatory strike with disproportionate results. And if that had succeeded, we would be talking about what did I think of the Israeli strike that happened two nights ago, right? So I think the one thing you haven't mentioned is something that they've used over the last two decades, which is covert operations. You know, they have had bombings and reputedly cyber attacks, with the United States, but they've had bombings. You know, they killed a job for which you life expectancy is low in Iran. As a ballistic missile engineer, I'll say, you know, they've had a lot of accidental explosions at their facilities. I have to believe to some degree Mossad and Israel involved in that. So you haven't mentioned that, although that doesn't have that deterrent effect, right? Because the plausible denial, you know, the whole idea of who did this, you know, F-35s going downtown, taking out refineries, IRGC headquarters, or even Natanz and the processing facilities. Only two countries could have done that. And we just said right away, it wasn't us, right? And so there would have been had a deterrent effect.
In deterrence theory, I don't know if you've watched The Three-Body Problem or if you read it. There's a lot of deterrence theory there. And I know Jerry Hendricks, your roommate at the Academy, and I talk about deterrence theory a lot. In deterrence theory, you can't respond to 330 missiles with anything significantly less. Or you are actually saying it's okay to hit us with 330. This is all we'll do. And second part of that question, if we don't hit the nuclear, we, Israel, don't hit the nuclear sites now, will they ever hit the nuclear sites? What's the message there to Iran if they don't act now after a direct attack of that size on Israel?
So I want to break that up into two thoughts. Your first thought about the size of the strike. It's not the size of the strike. It's the effect, right? So it doesn't have to be 330 missiles. In fact, you know, the reason, you know, 170 Shaheeds add up to about five tomahawks, right? In terms of likelihood of getting through and doing damage. So what I would say was I could take 10 Israeli land attack missiles properly employed by an F-35 and do enough damage, I believe, to say that was the response to 330. Now, look, there'd be a lot of damage in Israel. Either, as I said, a lot of dead IRGC leaders, a lot of oil refinery capacity taken offline. Now, if I wanted to take out their nuclear plant and a nuclear program and to get to that, that is a good question. I think the Israelis believe they can still do it. I think the United States is not 100% sure whether Israel can do it, but we're 100% sure we could do it if we had to. And we've always kind of hoped that this was a joint decision because the result will involve both our forces afterwards. If they do that, I think we're on a broad scale conflict in the Middle East. And look, I wouldn't put the blame for that on Israel. They have been pushed into a corner by a Iran that has taken the money it's gotten back from the administration over the last few years, funded Hezbollah, Hamas, IRGC proxy groups in Syria and Iraq and the Houthis and their own missile and nuclear weapons development. So they are pressuring Israel on five fronts. And so at some point, Israel may decide that they have to go right at the singular cause of their problem, which is the Iranian regime.
Now, Admiral, I'm going to ask this question, and then we're going to go to break. I'm going to talk to you off air. We'll put in the podcast play tomorrow, then we're going to come back on air. If Israel doesn't strike now, when would they strike? I mean, what excuse would they ever have? Because we have a clarity window open. Clarity windows opened after 10-7 and Saturday night. And the clarity window closes very quickly, doesn't it?
You know, I agree. In terms of a military strike, yes. The kind of large-scale military strike, that window is open. Now, there is a unique aspect to Israel where following Munich, following other, like, attacks on them, they have they've served their retaliation or their revenge cold. I think it took them almost 10 years to kill all the people involved with the Munich massacre in the 1972 Olympics. So they could go around and settle scores.
Okay, hold for a second, Admiral. We're going to go down because I'm going to ask you. Yeah, but the second part is, if not now, when? And if not the Israelis, who? So stay tuned. I'll be right back with Admiral Montgomery after the break, and we're going to talk off air. And I'll put it in the podcast, Highly Concentrated Hugh today, and we'll play it in the first hour tomorrow. Don't go anywhere, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Back with Admiral Mark Montgomery right now. Admiral, the question remains, if not now, when, and if not Israel? If they don't do it now, I don't know how they ever get away with world opinion.
I agree. In terms of the strike involving F-35s, maybe Jerichos, but probably mostly the F-35 strike aircraft. I think that has to go down in the next week. You know, they can, for moonlight purposes, other things, there's some adjustments. You know, you give yourself a week or 2 weeks so that you maximize your military operational efficiency. But, you know, they're going to be criticized by a certain group of people no matter what. But in terms of the kind of responsible leaders in Europe and the United States and Northern Asia that kind of look at these issues, that window of clarity is open, I think, for, you know, 7 to 10 days. If they don't do that, it's going to have to be one of these strikes where they very specifically say, you know, 7 months from now, we killed General X because General X planned this strike and we're holding him accountable at a later date, or just never say anything. A missile showed up in his window. I don't know how that happened.
You know, Admiral,
I'm
sure there are a lot of people in Iran who have jobs like me, where they just comment on affairs and they don't really know the technical side. They just comment on, unless you hit them over the head, unless you hit a radio talk show host over the head, they don't really get much, right? Isn't deterrence not only their leadership elite and their IRGC elite, but their people?
I agree. And I think they're in the position now where they're going to strike. They're probably working hard on the question you asked earlier of what's the target set. And as I said, there is a big Rubicon there, and the Rubicon is the nuclear facilities, the nuclear processing and development and the ballistic missile development facilities. Because they're deep, they will take a sustained hard attack, and there's a reasonable opportunity, eventuality of lost Israeli planes and pilots. Now, look, they're willing to, I believe they're willing to make that sacrifice if they decide that they can set back the program. Otherwise, it's going to be a very hard hit, one that even a radio announcer would feel, you know, where oil refineries are down, IRGC command posts are gone. So, you know, from my perspective, I think you're spot on. And I'd say 7 to 10 days. It is governed, as I said, a little bit by weather and atmospherics and moonlight, things like that, you know, that play into the effectiveness of stealth aircraft.
Now, Admiral, if they took losses on that and an F-35 went down, would the United States object to the loss of technology to the bad guys? Because they're part of the Russia-China axis. Pilot would be dead. That would be a loss to Israel. Our technology would be gone. What would you say about that?
Look, we're going to lose an F-35 in combat over time, you know, or one of our partners is. We've sold the F-35 to 20 plus countries, right? So they're out there. I think we would have to, suppress that kind of angst. Our F-35s are slightly different than theirs, but I would say Israel's and the UK's are pretty close to ours. So we would be disappointed, but, you know, you're eventually going to lose an F-35 in combat, and that's that. And, you know, when it falls from 20,000 feet, a lot of the important stuff gets damaged anyway. But my point on this is it's going to happen. we shouldn't say anything.
All right, Admiral, stand by. I'm coming back on the air with you in about 30 seconds. Be right back, America. Welcome back, America. Admiral Mark Montgomery is my guest from the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. Admiral, this morning, Israel took another hit in the north. Five Israelis hurt, one severely wounded. It's Hezbollah again. My question, Israel's got about 450,000 max if they mobilize all their reserves. Can they pull off an invasion of Lebanon as they conduct a strike against Iran and they wrap up in Gaza? Do you think they have the capability?
You know, if you'd asked me on October 8th, if Hezbollah had entered on October 8th, I'd have been nervous because I think Israel was on its back heels. They, you know, they had an existential moment on October 7th. They did not expect, they felt they were secure within their borders. They misunderestimated the ability of Hamas to conduct that strike. But I think in the 6 months since, they've really strengthened their ability to fight on the to be the military they thought they were, which is fight on a multi-front war. I think they can. I think the biggest problems they have right now is ammunition. Much, you know, like the United States, you know, you have spoken about this before. We allowed our munition levels, you know, pre-Ukraine to get down to about 25% of what we needed to fight either China or Russia or, you know, in the Middle East. We had just over time saved money there. Even the Israelis did a little bit of that, and they had less munitions than they would want for a multi-front war. They also had to put a lot of army forces into the West Bank because of the settler violence and the Palestinian terrorism that was going on there. So they were out of position, and they were lower on munitions than they'd want to be. They have been getting a lot of munitions from us, but they've been expending a lot of munitions in Gaza. So I think to be ready for that war, really, to do it right, they need to get, you know, air-to-ground weapons. They're called JDAM, but what they are is a weapon that goes from the air to the ground of either 250, 500, or 1,000 pounds. They need tank rounds, 120-millimeter tank rounds, and they need howitzer rounds, artillery, you know, 155-millimeter rounds. So we need to be pressing that to them. So what's the most important thing? The national security supplemental that is, you know, that Speaker Johnson is looking to roll out, I think, is four parts tonight, as early as tomorrow night, I think. And that's going to be critical. That $14.5 billion in there for Israel is about foreign military grants, FMF, for Israel to get munitions, maybe some presidential drawdown authority to pull munitions quickly from us, as opposed to ordering them from a company, which is what FMF does. And it's also got money for buying, you know, for building a Tamir factory. A Tamir is the weapon in the Iron Dome. It's for buying David's Sling, which is an a cruise missile. Defensive shot, and for something called Iron Beam, which is their directed energy weapon. So there's a lot of money in there. Oh, by the way, there's also some money to replenish the U.S. Navy for all the munitions this expended, both in the Red Sea and in the defense of Israel on Sunday night. So
Admiral, I want to close by making sure in this segment, in the 3 minutes after the break, you give me your general reaction to that attack on Saturday night, the defense that was thrown up, and whether or not in the future, it will be adequate to the evolving threat from hypersonics.
Ed, thanks for bringing this up, because this really was an impressive effort by the Israel Air Force and the U.S. Air Force, U.S. Navy, and also the U.S. Army and the British kicked in a little bit. Look, it proves something, and it's important, well known to kind of missile defenders like myself, which is that defense in depth is required. You know, you really needed those F-15s. You know, flying in over Iraq and Syria, you know, thinning the herd. So then you met then after those U.S. F-15s had done that aircraft, then the Israeli aircraft came in and no drones got to Israeli airspace. You know, that's phenomenal. Out of 170 drones. The second thing it did is it reminded us, you know, that we that you know, Russia, China, Iran, you know, all our all our adversaries really rely on cruise and ballistic missiles. So we better procure that defense in depth for ourselves. And our allies and partners need to be doing the same thing. It also reminded me that, you know, that thinning of the herd would be great in Ukraine right now. So where are the F-16s that the Biden administration's been, you know, promised for over a year and 4 months for now? They need to be in Russia so Russia can thin that herd, you know. The number one thing attacking critical infrastructure at night in Ukraine right now are Iranian Shahed drones sold to Russia. I think they're getting ready to do co-production in a factory soon. So, you know, to me, that's really important. Final thing I'll mention is hypersonics, not used, but the U.S. is doing a great job buying offensive hypersonics.
Hold on for a second, Admiral. We're going to go off. I'm going to have you finish on hypersonics during the break. We'll put it on the podcast play tomorrow. Don't go anywhere, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. That's Rear Admiral Mark Montgomery, retired United States Navy at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. I am back now with Admiral Montgomery. You gave me my first lesson in hypersonics, and I don't pretend to really understand it, but what were you about to say about the lessons we need to draw about hypersonics after Iran's attack on Israel?
So, look, the non-hypersonic weapons did not get through. I mean, ballistic, cruise, and drones did not get through. Hypersonics will get through right now. And we're doing a good job spending on offense. We're really creeping up from $3 to $5 to $7 billion a year on a number of hypersonic offensive programs. What we're not spending money on is hypersonic defense. The last three budgets from the administration have been declining, or somewhere around $190 million in the 2025 budget. So just to give you a perspective, about one-thirtieth the amount we're spending on the offensive side. And we can't allow Russia and China to have an offensive hypersonic capability. That is, weapons that aren't just hypersonic in speed, but maneuver during that. And you know, they're going to have those in 4 to 5 years in reasonable numbers. And Congress ordered the administration have an initial operating capability by 2029 that we can field in the Pacific. And unbelievably, they're lowering the budget for the research and development. That's causing the companies that build it to lay off or move engineers to other projects. We are actively not pursuing what's called a glide phase intercept in hypersonics. Mike Gallagher's talked, pushed the administration on this, Representative Mike Gallagher. I've written quite a bit about it. It is shocking to me, this lack of attention. In 2033, 2034, this administration will be held in very low regard when we face a China and Russia that have extensive offensive hypersonic capabilities, and we haven't fielded our glide phase interceptors.
Okay, last question, Admiral. We had a lot of ships in and around the area. I don't know how long we can surge that many ships. I don't know if you think we need to build more ships or hypersonics first, but you ran a carrier strike group. Did it perform exactly as you expected it to do, and does it prove the worth of the carrier going forward?
So for the carrier, you're right. It's not the carrier, it's the carrier strike group, because the carrier has been doing the offensive strikes into Yemen, strike the Houthi capabilities. But the defensive ships have done a fantastic job in doing this. And I'll just say real quickly, Admiral Servius would be proud. 12 years ago, he and I developed a relationship with Israel where Aegis would work with the Arrow systems to shoot down incoming Iranian and Iranian ballistic missiles. And the SM-3 had its first combat test Sunday night, and it passed.
Wow. Admiral Mark Montgomery from the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, please keep coming back. I hope are you writing something on lessons, early lessons from this? Or is it going to appear somewhere soon?
Yes, sir. I've got something out on this that we're getting ready on this air defense, particularly about the need for F-16s for Ukraine to thin the herd against Russia.
Well, thank you, Admiral. I look forward. Please send it to me. I look forward to having you back, and I appreciate you doing this on short notice and at length. Thank you, Admiral.
Thank you, sir.
Welcome back, America. I picked Africa for this because it didn't take a lot for me to stop interviewing Representative Gallagher, even after he retires from Congress. Welcome back, Congressman Gallagher. Your name was just invoked by Rear Admiral Mark Montgomery as being a proponent of developing an offensive hypersonic missile capability, which we do not have and we have to get. As you prepare to exit for a while from the public stage, do you think we're closer than when you began that campaign?
Maybe slightly, but as Admiral Montgomery knows better than anyone and has written about extensively, where I think we're still falling behind is on hypersonic defense. And there we just need to be moving much faster. In terms of hypersonic offense, the troubling revelation we found 2 years ago when the Chinese conducted a test of a hypersonic glide vehicle was that they did so. At the time, the intelligence community was surprised. There was an unnamed intelligence community official who was quoted as saying, "We have no idea how they did this, except we did, because they did it using U.S. technology." So even in the high end of defense technology, where you'd think we would have no connection between our economies, we have yet another example of the Chinese Communist Party stealing American technology to advance their military industrial complex with the goal of displacing America from the Indo-Pacific and ultimately displacing us as the world's sole superpower. So in a variety of areas, we're not moving fast enough. This is why the Select Committee has tried to shine a light on various things. And it's not just in the military domain, Hugh. Yesterday, we had a hearing on fentanyl with Attorney General Barr, former high-level DEA officials. We released a year-long investigation that revealed some novel and never-before-revealed things about how the Chinese Communist Party directly subsidizes lethal chemicals that are killing Americans on a scale akin to World War levels.
Now, Congressman, you're also going to get a vote on TikTok on tonight or tomorrow night, I believe, a second TikTok bill. Why are we doing this again in the House, and do you think this one will get through the Senate?
Well, so that it passes the Senate, because this will be part of a bigger package that the Senate, a national security package that the Senate hopefully will pass, as opposed to the Senate running an entirely different months-long process going through committee. This is the most expeditious way to get it passed. This would be perhaps the most consequential piece of legislation to pass this Congress. And so I salute Speaker Johnson for the approach that he's had to these bills. I think he recognizes that there's some disagreement in the caucus when it comes to Ukraine funding. He's trying to give separate votes on different aspects while ensuring that we are actually protecting ourselves, protecting our allies, prioritizing support to Israel. And as for the threat of a motion to vacate, I think if destructive members of our caucus want to bring that forward, we'll defeat it. And I think the speaker will emerge stronger on the other side of that debate. We simply can't live in fear of this constant motion to vacate. That basically surrenders control of the House to the Democrats. And so I think the speaker's on the right track. We should call this play today, and TikTok would be part of one of these bills. And I think the Senate, this is an example of the House. We usually get jammed by the Democratic Senate. This is the Republican House on the offensive, dictating the terms of the engagement. And I think the Senate would have to take up the bills that we pass. They're not perfect, but on balance, they are good for American national security and for the free world.
Now, the prior holder of the Dreyer chair to you is Senator Cotton, and Senator Cotton wants to send weapons to Ukraine. Admiral Montgomery just said they need those F-16s for the defense in depth against missiles that Israel demonstrated. Do you think F-16s will be in this package, or is it going to be a more ambiguous granting of weaponry funds? Because if they put in pension money, it becomes a problem for some people.
Yeah, I mean, I think it will be focused broadly on hard power and not pension. To the extent there's humanitarian assistance, I think the funding would require repayable loans. I've long said that that's an area where our European allies, or Western European allies in particular, who are perhaps more hesitant on the lethal assistance side, could step up, and they could be the ones that provide a lot more of the humanitarian assistance. But I do think systems like F-16 should be part of the package. I think we should provide clinical, targeted, lethal aid. Of course, we want robust oversight provisions. Ultimately, what we're doing here, whether it's with Ukraine funding, whether it's with Israel funding, whether it's with Taiwan funding, we're trying to revitalize our own defense industrial base, which has grown brittle, ossified. We're just not producing enough weapon systems that we're going to need in order to deter our adversaries. And look at what it took for Israel to, I mean, it was remarkable what they did technologically to shoot down this drone attack from Iran. But imagine what would happen if there was a more sophisticated attack going forward, or Hezbollah came in from the north. The fact is, we're just going to have to invest more in defense. Last week, I released a foreign affairs article written with Matt Pottinger that outlines a strategy for victory over China. And that is what we need to do. We need to win the competition. The Biden administration wants to manage the competition and cooperate wherever we can. It's not working. We have to commit ourselves to a decisive victory in the new Cold War with communist China. And the key component in securing victory is to rearm. We need to rearm aggressively before it's too late. And the Biden administration's latest budget is a complete joke. It cuts the number of ships that we're going to have. It's an inflation-adjusted cut to defense. This is not a serious budget for defense as you look at the numerous threats we face around the world. We need to rearm. We need to economically reduce our dependence on the Chinese Communist Party. And we need to recruit as many allies abroad and as many young Americans, new Cold Warriors, to the cause of serving their country. rearm, reduce, and recruit. That is how we beat the Chinese Communist Party, not just hope that they'll be nicer to us because we sat across from them at a negotiating table.
Congressman, I say there's something called the window of clarity, which opens up very rarely. It opened up on 10-7, and Americans understood what Israel was up against. It opened up again on Saturday night, and we know that Iran will do anything. If we do not, and if Israel does not strike their nuclear facilities now, do you imagine any circumstances under which we would do so?
Well, not under the current administration. I think the Biden administration will remain wedded to the Obama Middle East policy, which is to seek a detente, a rapprochement with the Iranian regime, to appease the Iranian regime, provide massive sanctions relief, no matter what they do, in order to stoke chaos in the region. I think that the moment of clarity, the window of clarity you mentioned, is precisely right, because remember, after October 7th, there was all sorts of attempts by the media and many in the Democratic Party to suggest that Iran was not connected to Hamas's attack on Israel. Of course, they were. Hamas is an outgrowth of the terror-sponsoring regime in Iran, despite being a Sunni Salafi jihadist organization and Iran being a Shiite theocracy. But that moment on Saturday night revealed that the head of the snake in the region is the Iranian regime. And if you don't have a regional policy that is built on rolling back Iran's malign influence and degrading, if not destroying, their nuclear program, you just have a recipe for chaos in the region. That's the only way that you get Israel working more closely with the Sunni Arab Gulf states economically, technologically, diplomatically. It's to build an alliance around the massive shared interests they have, around the long pole in the tent, and that is Iran. Iran is the head of the snake. Hezbollah is its terrorist organization, as is Hamas, as is Palestinian Islamic Jihad. And if you ignore that fact, as the Biden administration is trying to do, or if you try to segment different approaches or de-link your approach to Iran and your approach to Hamas, you're going to have a recipe for chaos, as well as add to that just the signaling that we've seen from the Biden administration rhetorically undermining Israel in its efforts to defend itself from a genocidal terrorist organization trying to destroy it.
Chairman Gallagher, for all your time in Congress, and especially as chairman of the Select Committee on Engagement with the Chinese Communist Party, you've been trying to push forward clarity on cyber capability, on TikTok, on China. And the world should know now that China is the head of the snake. Russia and Iran are below that. Below that are Cuba and Venezuela and a few other regimes like North Korea. And below that are these proxy terrorist groups. Do you think you have achieved clarity within the caucus and greater? Do they understand it's two worlds, the West and the anti-West? And the anti-West is led by the Chinese Communist Party. Do you agree with that? And do you think you've got other people clear on that now?
Well, certainly I agree with your framing. I've sort of called it an axis of authoritarian powers. China is the dominant player. Russia is the junior partner. But you also have Iran and North Korea in this axis of authoritarian powers. I believe we have achieved clarity on the threat posed by the Chinese Communist Party, but we still have persistent disagreements about what to do about it. But I was struck at the hearing we had yesterday with Attorney General Barr. I mean, look at what our findings revealed. The CCP directly subsidizes the mass production and export of fentanyl and precursors that are illegal to produce in China. They're funneling money to companies that it knows are engaging in criminal acts in order to kill Americans. The government owns and rewards companies who openly flout their own law and produce and sell illegal drugs that are killing Americans. So we have a form of chemical warfare underway that's killing tens of thousands of Americans every year. And you know how many Chinese died from fentanyl last year while 70,000 Americans did?
No.
Zero. Zero. That reveals something fundamental about the nature of the regime. And I'm struck by the Democratic rhetoric during the hearing, which suggests we are getting to a level of clarity on the primary enemy we face in Beijing.
Now, last question, Mr. Chairman. Next time I talk to you, I'm just going to call you Dr. Gallagher. I think they count that at Georgetown PhD as Dr. Gallagher. Chairman Gallagher, will you continue generally working on the China problem? Because there are very few people with your credibility on it.
Yes, it remains my life's work. Obviously, I'm at a point now where I have to step back from politics and want to prioritize my family, but my passion and my mission will remain the defense of America against the Chinese Communist Party. I've committed myself to the mission of deterring World War III. I know that sounds grandiose, but that is my passion. That's my life's work. And though my job title may change, and I never was one who wanted to stay in Congress for a long period of time, I don't believe that's what Congress should be. It shouldn't be a career. I'll find a different way to attack that same problem from the private sector and hopefully have more time to spend with my wife and my two daughters and grow our family as well.
And Dr. Gallagher will be as welcome here, provided you're not wearing that Packers idiocy stuff, you know. And the draft is coming up, and I don't think there are enough rounds to fill the Packer hole, so I'm sorry, Mike. Good to see you, Mr. Chairman. Good luck on draft night a week from tomorrow, right? Week from tomorrow. It's always a disappointment for the Packers fans because they never know quite what they're doing. But you get up there with Mark Murphy and you sit down. Maybe you'll help him on that next week. You're on the House Intel Committee. You could go up there and tell him who's a sleeper in the seventh round.
The draft's in Green Bay next year. Come to Green Bay next year for the draft.
You know, I don't think you're going to have to worry about hotel space up there. Congressman, thank you. I'll be right back, America. Stay tuned to the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Do you know, okay, a bit of a history lesson. Do you know that women were not, the women's teams were not allowed to have brackets until 2022?
Welcome back, America. That is our vice president. I'm joined by Mary Catherine Hamm of Getting Hammered fame. That's her podcast with Vic Mattis, which I've now been converted to by the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt. You know, I'm foreign policy, national security heavy, commentary, the School of War, things like that. But now, as my sort of my palate cleanser, I listen to Getting Hammered because it's hilarious. But I must say, Mary Catherine, you and Vic were really harsh on the vice president because she was only off by 40 years. What's 40 years?
I couldn't leave it on the table, Hugh. It is astounding how bad she is at speaking in public. It's actually its own kind of impressive. And some staffer, by the way, must have given her something that said something that suggested this. And she just sounds like glitching AI. Like you put a weird prompt at GPT about brackets. I don't think she even knows what brackets are, right? Well, it's very confusing. The thing makes no sense from top to bottom.
Well, a bit of history though, Mary Catherine Hammered. It was only last week that you left all of your clothes in a bathroom at a speaking engagement and had to approach the front desk. So just a bit of history. I don't know if glass houses and stones apply. You did disclose. You didn't leave all of your clothes. You were wearing clothes, but you left your change outfit.
No. So a couple things. One, that makes it sound much racier than the actual incident, which I appreciate because it will drive people to listen to Getting Hammered. Two, you're correct. My brain is like a glitching AI sometimes when it comes to keeping track of my stuff, but not when it comes to speaking in public and putting sentences together. That part I've got on lock. And if I were the vice president, which it comes with a nice house, I wouldn't mind it. I would handle that part.
Mary Catherine, I'm going to put you on the short list. With my short list is Tom Cotton, Mike Pompeo, Joni Ernst, Doug Burgum, and now Mary Catherine Hamm. That's my short list for Donald Trump. If you're asked, will you accept? If nominated, will you run?
Okay. No, you know, I can't say yes at this time because we live in a world where that's not entirely an impossibility because anything can happen in politics at this point. But Mr. Trump is not a fan, to my knowledge. I would go with a Joni Ernst or a Doug Burgum over me for sure.
Okay. I'm just saying it would be interesting. I have found Getting Hammered to be delightful. How many people download? Do you know? Do you follow?
I don't follow super closely, but I know it's like, you know, in the tens of thousands that listen, and we're happy to have any more that come our way. We do try to do we do serious news, but we try to be relaxed about it. We try to have a decent time.
Relaxed? You were drinking at 10 a.m.
I mean, those are the best episodes, in fact, and yet another indication that despite having a cocktail at that time of the day, I can put sentences together in a way that Kamala Harris will never dream of.
I want to know if your respective spouses, Vic Mattis is your co-host, and you have spouses. Do they object to the content and the revelations that kind of slip out about their personalities and their? I only refer to the fetching Mrs. Hewitt. I don't ever expand on her likes and dislikes, except when I melted her colander on the toaster and she got upset with me. But other than that, I've never told a fetching Mrs. Hewitt story.
Well, the thing is that my husband is so entertaining that I must tell stories about him. And the dynamic between us is so hilariously odd couple, because he's a person who would never lose track of his stuff in a million years. And if he did, I would wonder what seriously wrong thing was happening with him. So I have to sort of explain some of that. We don't go deep into stuff, right? I want to make sure that I'm respectful of my family when I'm telling these stories. So I try mostly to tell stories that reflect badly on me. Those are the
stories. We've got the reverse. He's a pack the night before person, like the fetching Mrs. Hewitt, and I'm a pack the morning of. And as a result, there's something always missing from my doc kit, and I always have to go to the hotel front lobby and say, have you got any toothpaste today? Have you got a razor? That's my MO. And so I totally identify that your husband is like my wife, but I really can't believe the opposite sex, anyone packs on the morning of. I really can't believe that.
Well, sometimes I don't now because my husband suggests very strongly that I do it the night before and I will pull it together the night before, but I'm comfortable doing it the morning of. And honestly, the last time when this terrible incident happened in the bathroom and I lost all my clothing, I thought I was really on top of things because I did pack the night before and look what happened, right? It just is who I am. Okay.
Okay, it's newsish. The episode is newsish, and it's two back. I haven't listened to the new one yet, but I'll be listening today as I ramble around the Beltway. I just wanted to give an homage to Getting Hammered. It's delightful. I enjoyed it immensely this week, and tell your husband my sympathies are with him. And I don't think you're not like Kamala Harris because you have brackets. You've got brackets.
Yeah.
Mary Catherine Hamm, follow her on X at MK Hammer. Follow Getting Hammered at your podcast site near you. Come right back. Want to remind everyone, a great sponsor of the program is MyPhDWeightLoss.com. Generalissimo went on that program more than a year ago, lost 50 pounds. He's kept it off. And stress eating is not allowed, I don't believe, even though we're under a lot of...
Sure tempted to this week, aren't we?
Everybody is, but we don't... I'm sure they give you tricks of the trade to combat that because that's one of the habits. You broke that habit. You're not going by Del Taco or Taco Bell.
Have not. No.
You haven't relapsed.
Have not relapsed.
And it's healthy, it's wise, it's productive.
864-644-1900.
That's
864-644-1900.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Jesse Waters is the face of Fox News. My 30-something son tells me, and he's right, and he's got a fabulous new book out. And I want to say, this is entertaining as can be. Get It Together, Troubling Tales from the Liberal Fringe. I got to tell you, I am loving Get It Together. Before I go there, though, you are only 43, and you had microdiscectomy? What did you do to your back?
Sitting is the new smoking. And so, you know, I have two shows, Hugh. So that's 2 hours. And then I'm preparing for the show, and I've just been sitting my whole life.
Well, what I loved is that you blamed your producer. I blame my producer for everything. And so That we have in common, so it's always the producer's fault. But I thought, my God, a microdiscectomy. You're going to be, you know, I've had bad backs for the last 20 years, but I ran a lot of marathons. What did you do?
Gosh, Hugh, you're making me sound like a weak man who didn't run marathons.
I've never heard of anyone.
I sat a lot because I'm so studious and I'm so well prepared that I was always hunched over a book or a computer.
Well, you are well prepared and get it together. And I want to go to two stories. There are 22 different stories. I'm going to do my two favorite. My very favorite one is the climate activist, the traffic blocking climate extremist. This guy from Kalamazoo, who now lives in Washington, who has to sell his townhouse to keep doing it. How did you find him?
So we had my producers reach out to some of these zany people, and this is the guy that sits Indian style on the freeway and draws attention to climate change. And I said, has anybody ever gotten out of their car after sitting blocked in traffic for 3 hours and said, you know what, thank you, now I'm buying a Prius? And he said, no, I have not changed a single person's mind in doing this. And you'll hear this throughout the book, is that these people are mostly doing these things for themselves. They're expressing their feelings, whether it's about the climate, the prison system, the border. And it really has nothing to do with rationality or results. It really has to do with them kind of lashing out at society and projecting their trauma on the rest of us. And when I say get it together, that's something my mom told me. I'm sure your mother told you. It's one look directly in the eye, get it together.
And yeah, my mantra with my kids, Jesse, was always focus and execute. And they'll laugh whenever I say it because I said it 5 million times. Your mom said get it together. As a dad, I say focus and execute. But let's go back to Paul because yes. Paul fascinates me. At one point you ask him, do you consider this climate crusade a type of religious movement? And he says, I feel strongly about it, but it's not a religion. It's obviously a religion, Jesse. Did you argue the case with him?
Well, you know, I try not to argue too much with these people because, you know, you don't suffer fools. I suffer fools, and that's just my station in life. And I listened, and I found out at this age it helps to listen. And instead of being combative, I just let them pour their heart out. And I found out I learned a lot more by listening because you get to a certain point. When someone's in their 40s and their 50s, you can't persuade these people. That's why we got to get them young. Because right now you get a lot of people who are basically juvenile delinquents at 45 years old. And they're living lives of teenagers. They're doing drugs. They're drinking. And then they say, you know what? Society needs to accommodate to my problems. I don't have problems. It's society that needs to change. And that's
why
you got to get these people early.
I also, though, I don't push back in most of my interviews unless it's someone with whom I have a political disagreement and it's civil. But I am suspicious of Paul. I don't believe he had a real job for 35 years. I don't believe he was a banker because unless he had kind of a break, in which case I would feel sympathy for him. Did he give off any of the indicia of mental illness to you? Because I really don't believe a banker could do that. It's so irresponsible. Someone will have to pay for his retirement. He's going to sell his townhouse.
That was the catch 22 of someone like Paul. You live a life where you're an accountant, you're a mortgage broker, and that is probably the most logical job you could have. You're basically doing math all day and mitigating risk. And this guy all of a sudden lives this incredible pragmatic lifestyle and then has this psychic break and quits his job, drops out of society, but never really had saved enough for retirement and is now forced to sell his house. And he doesn't really have a plan. And this is what you find with these people is that they are having a hard time living their own truth because it doesn't make any sense.
Well, Get It Together has got a bunch of them.
Irrational.
Let me turn to the second one because I want to get to a couple of questions related to it. Second one is our University of Toronto professor, Joe Caron. And you say, quote, I'm convinced that Joe the plumber, now deceased, is smarter than Joe the professor. So am I. What do you think he's doing to his students? You, in the introduction, you write, sociopathic parents are creating a strange generation. I'm blaming a lot of the college professors, too. Do you?
I think the root cause of a lot of these, and I call them borderline personality disorders. You call it a mental illness. It's very similar. It really does begin at the home, and then it's laundered through the university system. You basically have dysfunctional parents who then send their children off to dysfunctional universities where college professors kind of work out their own issues on these kids. And then you spit out at age 22 people with really, really, really problematic lifestyles. And they think they're justified. So this is a guy who I think lost his faith in God at Yale Divinity School.
Yes.
He became an atheist at Yale Divinity School, ended up, divorcing his wife and marrying a women's study professor, and then leaving for Canada, and advocates for open borders all over the world.
Yeah, it's so absurd that the university, I think he taught at Princeton too. I don't have that in my notes, but I think I recall he taught at Princeton. And then he goes up to the University of Toronto, and he's an open borders guy. And he does not apparently understand sovereignty, Jesse. Do you find that these people who are allegedly quite smart fail to grasp very basic concepts? Like, we can't actually have open borders, or fentanyl will fall into our country like a wave, like the tsunami that hit Sri Lanka.
A lot of these people are snobs. These are intellectual snobs who are social climbers, and they want to appear to be smart. And in trying to appear to be smart, they do and say the dumbest things in the world. We talked about this on The Five yesterday. You have a Supreme Court nominee who can't define what a woman is. You have a Harvard president who doesn't understand saying death to the Jews is harassment. You have politicians who say walls don't work, or public health officials that think closing schools for 2 years are greater, corporate CEOs that want to trade our factories for fentanyl, and they claim to be the elite. And the rest of the country's looking at them, and we're saying, we're not bitter. You guys are just stupid, and you're destroying the country. And when you look at someone like Paul, who can't really even back up his arguments, I say, Paul, you know, what if a guy crosses the border illegally, comes here, has a DUI, almost kills someone, should he be deported? And he says no. And so you go through these laundry list of examples, and they don't do hypotheticals. All they do is theory.
All theory.
You issue a hypothetical, they can't handle it because they don't live in a concrete world. They live in a fantasy land. And what it turned out with him was he was sexually abused in the Catholic Church at a very early age and held this deep animosity towards institutions that weren't able to protect him as a young child. And in order to kind of reconcile that, he said, I'm going to tear all the institutions down, right? I'm going to tear the border down. I'm going to tear the government down, I'm going to tear the police system down, and I'm just going to rip everything apart. No borders, no law and order, and that's my way of getting back at the institution that failed to protect me.
It is tragic, it is compelling, and it's not alone. There are others. I got one last question for you. I don't know. I didn't see The Five yesterday, which I think, by the way, no offense intended to anyone or to the Waters Report, anything else to Sean, who's been my friend forever. The Five is the best show on television, and it's the best show on television because it moves fast and it's funny. But did you talk about Catherine Mayer at NPR? Because I was reading this book, Get It Together, and I kept thinking to myself, if Jesse got a hold of Catherine in a very non-confrontational way, she would reveal herself to be chapter 24 in this book, right?
Yeah, so these people you find out are narcissists. And most of these people on the fringe are narcissists. And if you invite them on television, they don't want to do it because it's 5 minutes live. They can't handle it. But if you say, hey, Catherine, I'd like to do a 4-hour interview about your life, and it's for a book project, and it's not going to be for television, they will come on, and they will pour their heart and souls out and tell me their deepest, darkest secrets. And what you find out about someone like Catherine, I mean, look at her resume. It is probably the most radical resume, Atlantic Council, State Department, Wikipedia. And you go in through her social media profile, and it's to the left of leftists. She actually criticized Hillary Clinton for not being woke enough because she didn't like the way Hillary said boys and girls because she didn't think that was gender inclusive enough.
Hey, stand by for a second, Jesse. I want to talk to you off air so I can put it in the podcast as well. The book is Get It Together, Troubling Tales from the Liberal Fringe. It's really quite amusing. and very illuminating. And if you get it together, you will get it together. I'll talk to Jesse after the break. Put it on highly concentrated view as well.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
I am back with Jesse Waters. Jesse, I've been doing this since 1990. I've interviewed probably 30,000 people, and I've done some long interviews. I've never done a four-hour interview. I did Richard Dreyfuss for 3 hours because I would, you know, my patience wears out. How do you brace yourself for 3 hours of idiocy? And Richard Dreyfuss, by the way, is very smart. That was fascinating, but some of these people are quite bizarre.
Attracted. Idiocy. And you used to see me on the O'Reilly Factor. Remember,
yes.
I used to go out in the street and interview people, and I was only able to get them for about 5 minutes. But I'm curious, and curiosity has not killed this cat. And so I said, listen, talk to me for as many hours as it takes. Tell me everything about what makes you tick. And so you talk to someone who identifies as a wolf, you.
Yeah.
This person, I guess, is transgender, he, she, God knows what. But they literally identify as a wolf. They howl. They frolic in wolf sanctuaries. Spiritually, they identify as a wolf. And these are the kind of things that fascinate me. And then they moonlight, no pun intended, as people that go after child predators on the internet. And so, you know, you sit down, you listen, you find out what they believe, why they believe it. And what the book project ended up telling me was that a lot of these people really don't, you know, read John Locke and understand, you know, this is why I believe in this policy. These are people
who have rough
lives. But do you approach
it? Yeah, Brian Lamb, who's the best in the business until he retired. Brian had a deadpan face. He never gave away what he thought about a response. And he would do these long 3-hour interviews about people's lives. And I did it with Brian. Is that what are you deadpan? Do they not know it's Jesse Waters and that this is not going to turn out well?
Well, listen, Hugh, if you were a liberal and you were to tell your life story to someone, would it be to Jesse Waters?
No.
But I am open-minded. You know, my mother's a liberal and she taught me to be tolerant and open-minded. And I didn't judge these people. I judged silently. And many of the people we've interviewed for the book have come back to do Jesse Waters Primetime, to do promotion. And they say that they were treated fairly in the book. And I was a good listener. And that's all you can ask for. Shining the spotlight.
Congratulations. A lot of times a book comes out from someone with a TV show. The exceptions are usually at Fox, like Brett, and I think of a bunch of your co-hosts, and there are great books that come out. Greg's been a guest, and Dana's been a guest. They're good books. This one is very surprising, and I think people will enjoy Get It Together. Congratulations. Keep pushing on. I don't know if you're going to get Volume 2, though, Jesse. You think people are going to be ready to sit down with you still for Volume 2?
We're going to do Volume 2 on successful people. How does that sound?
There you go. I would like to hear that, too. Jesse Waters, congratulations. Have a good day on The Five and on The Jesse Waters Show. Later on Fox, the face of Fox, going forward for the next 30 years. Right there, Jesse Waters. Stay tuned.